headlines. Russia's president, in a meeting with his Syrian counterpart, slams the presence of illegitimate foreign forces in Syria as a hindrance to the Arab country's consolidation. Palestinians in Al-Quds district go on a commercial strike in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Also in the headlines, southern Chinese cities close schools and order testing for millions in a race to curb a new COVID-19 outbreak. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has hailed the Syrian government's control over much of the Arab country. Putin made the comment as he met with his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad in the Russian capital, Moscow. The Russian president said that the government in Damascus is now in control of more than 90% of Syrian territory. Putin said Syria's problem is the presence of what he called illegitimate foreign troops on his soil. He added those forces deployed without a UN decision are a hindrance for Syria's consolidation. The meeting between Putin and Assad follows recent gains by the Syrian army in the southwestern province of Daraa. The army has regained two key areas from foreign-backed militants there. A group of Palestinians have gone on a strike in occupied Al-Quds, solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinians have stopped working in Issawiya neighborhood of Al-Quds. They have slammed Israel's treatment of Palestinian inmates and called on the international community to take action. On Monday, nearly 1,400 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails announced an open-ended hunger strike. They said their action will begin on Friday. The inmates want the Israeli regime to end what they see as a policy of repression and abuse against prisoners. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have also held a rally in solidarity with thousands of inmates inside Israeli jails. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has announced that a ship carrying fuel from Iran has arrived in Syria's Baniyas port. He added that the transfer of the shipment to Lebanon would begin on Thursday. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said on Monday that the first Iranian fuel shipment has reached the Baniyas port in Syria and will be transported by land to Lebanon this week.
The transport of fuel from Syria to the Vika begins Thursday and it will be stored in specific tanks and a second ship will arrive in Baniyas within a few days. The third ship, which I have mentioned before, has been prepared. All managerial prerequisites have been accomplished so the vessel will be ready to sail. We're also preparing the logistics for the fourth shipment. About a month later, we'll see if we need a fifth or sixth ship. I have to clarify that we don't seek any gains on this fuel. We'll be for all Lebanese and everyone who lives in Lebanon.
In his Talvi speech, Sayyid Nasrallah noted that Hezbollah will offer a one-month fuel donation to state-run hospitals, nursing homes, orphanages, disability centers, state-run water institutions, municipalities that have water wells, the civil defense, and the Lebanese Red Cross. Experts believe the speech highlights a roadmap Hezbollah has put forth to alleviate the fuel crisis the Lebanese people are dealing with, in light of the government's inactivity and at the same time challenges pressures imposed by the West against the nation.
Hezbollah's decision to bring in fuel and even warned enemies that it will be considered Lebanese assets and that any strike on the ships will lead to retaliation was a very influential issue. It dealt a blow to the U.S. sanctions, whether against Iran, Syria, or Lebanon. The fact that the ship has reached its destination safely and has unloaded its cargo is in itself a victory.
The Hezbollah chief stressed that the resistance's deterrence power kept the ship safe. He said once the shipment reaches its destination, the fuel will be distributed carefully to prevent any potential profit seekers from taking advantage.
Lebanon has been sleeping in the dark for many nights. Sayyid Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah's initiative to bring in fuel to Lebanon from Iran will not only bring electricity, it will also break the current U.S. sanctions against the country. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The International Atomic Energy Agency says that its recent arrangements with Iran allowing for continued surveillance of nuclear activities does not have any specific time frame. The IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi says that Iran and the agency have adopted a practical approach that is meant to serve as a bridge between now and a time when the nuclear deal is back in place. Maleski reports.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors opens a weekly session just the day after IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's trip to Tehran. Grossi had raised concerns about IAEA access to monitoring equipment in Iran and safeguards-related questions about the country's past nuclear activities. Rafael Grossi said no one could expect him to resolve the outstanding safeguards-related issues with Iran within a 10-hour visit to the country. The most urgent matter, however, the imminent loss of IAEA data, had been adequately addressed. The IAEA's surveillance cameras will now continue to record data that will be kept in Iran under joint seals. But for how long? Apparently, as long as it takes for talks to revive the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA to bear fruit.
You may have seen that this issue of the length has not been addressed. And the fact is that we, having discussed this, we agreed that it is better and more practical to go about it as developments evolve. It is a breach to give us some monitoring and verification capacity until there is something hopefully better.
Grossi said he would soon travel back to Iran to have a clear conversation with the new Iranian government, which in his words has very firm ideas with regards to nuclear activities. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says all of the country's nuclear activities, including enrichment at the 20 and 60% levels and the production of uranium metal, are within Iran's rights under the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in line with the country's safeguards commitments. Kazem Gharibabadi says since the US's unilateral sanctions against Iran are still in place and the other sides have not lived up to their commitments under the nuclear deal to remove them, nobody can demand that Iran stop these activities. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
The British government has threatened to suspend the Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed with the European Union under their Brexit deal last year. The Brexit Minister, Lord Frost, said that London is ready to take the step if the European Commission refuses to renegotiate the document. His comments came after the ruling party in Northern Ireland threatened to collapse the regional parliament over the protocol. The European Commission has said renegotiating the Northern Ireland Protocol will lead to more instability for people and businesses. The document has already created massive problems for Britain's Northern Ireland by imposing checks on transit of goods with EU member Ireland. The UK has so far voluntarily kept the checks suspended. China has closed schools and ordered testing for millions in Fujian province following a new COVID outbreak. All schools in the city of Putian have stopped in-person classes. Public venues like cinemas and gyms have been shut also. The nearby city of Xiamen has followed suit and shut down long-distance bus services. Fujian province in the southeast China reported 59 new locally transmitted cases on Tuesday. They were up from 22 infections a day earlier. The outbreak began in Putian on September 10 and spread to two other cities since then. Total infections are now 102. Authorities say that the cluster's suspected patient zero was a man who had recently returned from Singapore. The U.S. has expressed its willingness to hold talks with North Korea after Pyongyang tested a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend. The White House said its position toward North Korea has not changed and that it remains prepared to engage with the East Asian nation. Pyongyang says its nuclear and ballistic programs are essential to defend the country against the U.S. invasion. Talks aimed at denuclearizing the North collapsed in 2019 after the U.S. failed to lift sanctions. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, says that North Korea has the upper hand in any potential talks with the U.S.
So the U.S. is not willing to condemn these tests to any kind of a strong degree. Instead, they are merely reiterating their previous stance that they are willing to hold talks with the North. And the North now has the upper hand at the bargaining table if the U.S. decides that it is going to concede more to the North in terms of allowing the North not to have any more sanctions imposed either by the U.S. or the U.S.-led international community, which means the U.N. nations. Well, unfortunately, many experts say that the current U.S. President Joe Biden is less willing even than the former U.S. President Donald Trump to be flexible and try to hold dialogue with the North. This is alarming to many people, this kind of stance of the new U.S. president. And in fact, many people here in South Korea were opposed to the U.S. president being elected. They favored Trump because they felt that if Trump was reelected, he would no longer have that kind of public pressure on him not to negotiate with North Korea and make some real concessions.
The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has faced a grilling at Congress over the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan.
I want to know how many Afghan citizens came to the United States that had not met the qualifications for a special immigrant visa?
We're in the process of
How many did you bring? You were just at Dulles. How many did you bring?
We will have, by the end of the month, we will have brought a total of approximately 60,000.
That have not met the SIV process.
Some of those will have been through the SIV process. All of them, regardless of SIV status, will have gone through rigorous security checks.
It'd be nice if that was done before we brought these people to the United States of America.
Blinken was answering questions at a House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, where he faced strong criticism over the developments in Afghanistan. Top U.S. diplomat defended President Joe Biden's decision to withdraw forces before the August 31st deadline. Blinken, however, blamed the administration of former President Donald Trump for signing a deal with the Taliban. He noted that the Biden administration inherited a deadline for the pullout and not a plan. Foreign troops scrambled to leave Afghanistan last month, putting an end to the 20-year-long war in the Central Asian country. Political commentator Jason Unruha believes the U.S. president could have come up with a better arrangement with the Taliban to withdraw American troops from Afghanistan.
Well, he could have renegotiated, but I don't think that's something that the United States is willing to do. I mean, breaking agreements is nothing new for the U.S., so I don't see why they think that they would lose face in any way by doing so. It is something that they do very commonly, but it wouldn't have taken very much just to sit down with the Taliban and say, okay, we need a little bit more time to get everything out. We are leaving. You can see that we're leaving. We definitely are. We just want to get the rest of our equipment out. And then they could have made some kind of offer, maybe cut back on the rhetoric on trying to block foreign aid to Afghanistan. Could have made a simple donation. Okay, maybe if you let us pull our stuff out, maybe give us a week extension to get rid of all our equipment, we'll send you X amount of food aid, and I think that would have been perfectly acceptable.
The Taliban in Afghanistan have denied rumors that senior official Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar has been killed or injured in clashes with rivals. In a Twitter message, a Taliban spokesman cited Baradar, saying that the claims were lies and totally baseless. The Taliban also released video footage purportedly showing him at meetings in the southern city of Kandahar. Baradar is the co-founder of the Taliban. The group named him the deputy prime minister in its new government announced last week. There were rumors in recent days that Baradar's supporters had clashed with loyalists of Taliban interior minister Sirajuddin Haqqani. The group has denied speculations over internal divisions. The U.S. National Weather Service says the Gulf Coast of Texas and Louisiana face a life-threatening situation as Hurricane Nicholas batters the region with heavy rains. Nicholas has now strengthened from a tropical storm to a hurricane. Millions of residents are under storm surge, flood, and tropical storm warnings. As it moves northeast, Nicholas is expected to dump heavy rain on parts of south-central Louisiana and southern Mississippi. The U.S. President Joe Biden has declared an emergency for Louisiana. Officials have warned that Hurricane Nicholas could knock out electricity and disrupt restoration efforts in Louisiana. The southeastern state is still reeling from destruction caused by another Hurricane Ida that hit a couple of weeks ago. Lawmakers in the European Parliament condemn the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel for engaging in the illegal practice of spying on EU citizens. Experts have told Parliament that the scale of the problem goes far beyond than what is known. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
It has been known for a long time that the United States is guilty of espionage against its closest ally, the European Union. The matter has just been debated in the European Parliament. It is time the 27-nation bloc had its own intelligence agency to respond, lawmakers suggest.
Le 30 mai dernier.
Just look at the 30th of May,
Media investigations showed that Denmark and the NSA cooperated in spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French, Norwegian, Swedish, German journalists.
The fact that EU member Denmark has been working with the US to spy on other EU nations is surely a scandal. Also, Israel has been condemned in the European Parliament for selling its Pegasus military spyware to Saudi Arabia so that Riyadh can hack into the phones of EU politicians, government advisers, lawyers, journalists, and academics.
How do you think the world should approach the Israeli government in regards to its involvement? What should be the precedence so that we deter such cases in the future?
The answer, critics argue, is that EU authorities will do nothing because they are afraid of upsetting Washington, Riyadh, and Tel Aviv. Some claim motives for this activity given by the US do not add up.
I think America uses the terrorism concept a lot to promote its surveillance agenda. And that's a concern because I think the actual figures of persons who are afflicted by terrorism is actually quite small.
Turning a blind eye to the problem is an insult to citizens, one expert told the European Parliament debate.
All intelligence activity impinges on human rights. It just does. So it impacts on your right to enjoyment, maybe freedom of movement, it might be right to communication and all the rest of it. So the key point there is on the legality.
Another expert who was invited to the debate told legislators that we are only seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to foreign nations spying on the EU. Margarita Carrillo from the University of Canada warned that this problem is never going to go away, and therefore EU authorities need to come up with a firm plan in order to preserve the bloc's much-talked-about values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The necessity for Muslim countries to cooperate with one another on the pivot of Palestine and Quds, May 7th, 2021. In this auspicious future, cooperation between Muslim countries should be a main and fundamental goal, and this does not seem unlikely. The pivot around which this cooperation turns is the issue of Palestine, the entirety of that country, and the fate of Holy Quds. This is the same truth that guided the enlightened heart of the great Imam Khomeini, may God bestow mercy upon him, towards the announcement of International Quds Day on the last Friday of Ramadan. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Cooperation between Muslims around the pivot of Holy Quds is an absolute nightmare for the Zionists and for their American and European advocates. The failed project called the Deal of the Century and the effort to normalize the relations between a few weak Arab governments and the Zionist regime's desperate attempts to run away from that nightmare. I tell you with confidence, these attempts will not get them anywhere. The downward movement of the Zionist enemy has started, and it will not stop moving downward. There are two determining factors in the future. First and foremost is the continued activities of resistance in the Palestinian lands and the strengthening of the line of jihad and martyrdom. And second, global support on the part of governments and Muslim nations throughout the world for the Palestinian mujahids. All of us, government officials, intellectuals, religious scholars, political parties and groups, the brave youths and people of various social backgrounds should determine our position in this public movement and play our part. This is what nullifies the enemy's plots, and it will be an apocalyptic manifestation of this Quranic verse. Or do they intend a plot, but those who defy Allah are themselves involved in a plot? The Holy Quran, chapter 52, verse 42. And Allah has full power and control over his affairs, but most among mankind do not know. The Holy Quran, chapter 12, verse 21.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the U.S. administration, led by then-President George W. Bush, declared a war on terror and invaded Afghanistan in October 2001. 20 years later, the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan marked the end of a protracted war that cost thousands of lives and trillions of dollars. 20 years of intervention in order to protect Afghanistan and to build a decent defensive military force for the nation, however, Kabul's pack of cards collapsed as the Taliban took over the country with no trouble. Afghanistan is a perfect example of the U.S. hegemony and military presence under the pretext of fighting terrorism. A big failure for a nation that feels it has to police the world. As of July 2021, the U.S. has more than 750 military bases in at least 80 countries worldwide. The actual number is probably higher, as the Pentagon has not published all the data. Washington entered the Middle East in a bid to hunt the man who they believed masterminded the 9/11 attacks. the Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, who was harbored by the Taliban in Afghanistan. They later invaded Iraq in 2003. Up to 3 million U.S. service members have served in Afghanistan and Iraq since 2001, with over half of them deployed more than once. The U.S. also has had an active military presence in Japan since the end of World War II and in South Korea since the Korean War in the 50s. Nearly half of the U.S. military forces deployed abroad are stationed in these two countries, with 80,000 service members. Elsewhere, Europe is home to some 60,000 American troops. Meanwhile, the U.S.'s most controversial and oldest military base abroad is located in Cuba, the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. The U.S. has controlled the base since the end of 19th century. Since 2002, the naval base has contained a military prison to hold inmates in a place neither the U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism.
Well, the impulse behind the United States transition from Republican democracy to empire started in the late early 1990s with the fall of the Soviet Union, and that is when the acceleration of the U.S. military-based development expanded greatly, because the military-industrial complex, the general defense contractors, the bankers were seeking a transition to empire. And with the crumbling of the Soviet Union, they exploited these opportunities to try and position U.S. bases all around Russia with the agenda to cannibalize it, and had the self-supporting delusion that the United States was now the heir apparent to dominate and control the world.
In 2020, the U.S. was the largest military spender in the world and more than the next 10 countries combined, as it has spent $778 billion on its military. Over the past two decades, the U.S. has spent $8 trillion on its so-called war on terror that only caused more instability across the globe. The U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh would never have formed. Following the 9/11 attacks and the declaration of war on Afghanistan in 2001 and Iraq in 2003, the U.S. saw a large spike in the number of its troops abroad. At least 800,000 Americans served in Afghanistan and more than 1.5 million in Iraq over the past 20 years. The human cost of the U.S. so-called war on terror is estimated to have killed more than 900,000 people, mostly civilians.
It not only violates the sovereignty of individual nations where the U.S. has forcibly impregnated itself in and established military bases in these countries, but it more importantly violates the fundamental core of our human existence. God made men and women to be free, to seek Him and to enjoy life on earth, not to exist as a slave to another. And the United States and its military expansion and its ambitions for bases really is a transformation of slavery.
It seems the U.S. aim behind all these military bases is to exert its own foreign policy directives under the pretext of policing the world. Although supported by international legal agreements, the presence of foreign troops violates a country's sovereignty.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
So at least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help, because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives. Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. The Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road, considering how big a figure the bill earmarked.
Well, you know, that's a false argument. What the Republicans are really about is that they don't want to spend on these stimulus programs, because if the stimulus programs spending amounts to significant fiscal stimulus, then they'll have to raise taxes on corporations and investors, which means they'll have to reduce some of the generous Trump tax cuts of 2017 that gave $4.5 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and wealthy individuals and investors. They would have to raise taxes, and that's really what it's about. They don't want to raise those taxes. They don't want to take away the Trump tax cuts if they got to have to spend a lot on social programs.
With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
Israel is stepping up its hawkish warmongering rhetoric against Iran. The chief of staff of Israel's military has said the regime is putting more extensive plans in place for when it decides to, quote, attack Iran.
Aviv Kohavi claims the regime has, quote, greatly accelerated preparations for action against Iran's nuclear program. He says a considerable increase in the budget has been allocated to that purpose, with more intelligence and operational capabilities assigned. Kohavi also said Israeli military's current main objective is to stem what he called Iran's presence in the Middle East, with an emphasis on Syria and elsewhere. Those operations are taking place all over the Middle East, against Hamas in Palestine, against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Earlier this month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz said in an interview that the regime was prepared to attack Iran, saying that, quote, we are at a point where we need to take military action against Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has implicitly acknowledged that the regime has carried out covert attacks on Iran's peaceful nuclear program and brazenly said that the regime would keep on with such attacks.
And the reason behind its stepped up hostility toward Iran and a very open hostility is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Iran has already condemned Tel Aviv's reckless rhetoric against Tehran. Late last month, the Iranian envoy to the United Nations warned Israel against any adventurism toward the Islamic Republic. In a letter to the President of the United Nations Security Council, Zahra Ershadi, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Iran to the UN, warned the regime against carrying out its threats of attacking Iran over its peaceful nuclear program. Unchecked, such continued unlawful acts and systematic provocative measures, with all their serious ramifications, would undoubtedly further destabilize the region and also endanger international peace and security.
It was not just when Netanyahu, with all of his ridiculousness, his cartoonish presentations and so forth, his obsession with Iran's development, it's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something.
Being Naftali Bennett's visit to the United States last week, Tel Aviv and Washington agreed to form a high-level team to tackle the Iran nuclear issue. Israel's threats against Iran are believed to be aimed at influencing stalled nuclear talks between Tehran and other world powers.
Well, Israel definitely wants to prevent any possibility of success for a return to the JCPOA, the so-called nuclear deal. And so it's moving in this direction.
However, analysts believe Washington's options outside of diplomacy with Iran are limited. A military option would be unacceptable to the top Pentagon brass, who have engaged in enough war games and other scenarios to recognize that there is no workable military solution. It is believed that Israel presumably recognizes that a military option would also be counterproductive.
The United States marked the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The world will probably never forget that fateful day in 2001, which changed the course of history. U.S. investigators said the Al-Qaeda terror group was behind the whole thing. America said it had evidence showing that the attacks were planned and led from inside Afghanistan. This triggered the invasion of Afghanistan that bogged down the U.S. military for 20 years. Two decades later, the family members of 9/11 victims are still struggling to find answers. They have long been pursuing accountability from another country, Saudi Arabia. Most of the hijackers who carried out the attacks were Saudi nationals. That is not all that ties the kingdom to the complicated plot. Long classified documents have revealed that some of the hijackers had been in contact and received support from individuals connected to the Saudi government. They also show that the phone number of then Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan, was in the phone book of a close associate of Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden. The families of victims said in a statement last month that evidence implicates Saudi government officials in supporting the attacks. The families have long argued that Saudis had advanced knowledge of the plot, but did nothing to stop it. The families of the victims have been pushing for the release of more 9/11 documents that successive U.S. administrations have kept secret. Biden has made up his mind about the upcoming anniversary. He will visit all three sites where hijacked planes crashed 20 years ago to commemorate the victims. But will his administration give the victim families what they've been demanding so long? They want to know for certain if Saudi Arabia aided the hijackers. Some of the still-secret files relate to an FBI investigation known as Operation Encore that focused on the two hijackers who lived in San Diego and individuals who may have assisted them. A former FBI agent who was involved in the investigation has said that he is confident that the two hijackers had a U.S.-based support network. Riyadh still denies any involvement in the 9/11 plot. It is now fighting a lawsuit brought by the families in federal court in New York. Why have successive U.S. governments been reluctant to release the files so many years after the horrific event?
It has been a mystery why the U.S. has been covering up for connections to Saudi Arabia throughout these last 20 years. So that's why the 9/11 families have had their lawsuit and tried through the courts to get access to this information. But, you know, it's not just the 9/11 families. The entire public of the United States deserves to know what happened on 9/11 and before 9/11, deserves to know what connections the U.S. has been covering up for.
U.S. authorities have argued that any release of more files could result in damage to the national security. But some observers believe Saudi lobbies in America could have played a role in blocking the very long-awaited release. Top U.S. officials also seem reluctant to sour lucrative ties between America and the autocratic kingdom by thoroughly investigating the clues about possible Saudi government involvement in 9/11 events.
The close relationship that the U.S. government has with Saudi Arabia has made it very difficult for the 9/11 families to get the access to the information they deserve and they need to prosecute the case that has been going on for 20 years against the 9/11 hijackers.
Will the Biden administration, which has promised more transparency, act differently?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems, issues parents face when raising the children in an Islamic way. The answers are, as usual, all based upon the holy book of the Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us yet again. Our topic is still about how to correctly fix the mistakes and wrongdoings of our children when they commit them. So far, we've spoken about how we should fixate on the cause of the problem and not on the child, and not to blame him. And we've also said most times the parents, they forget to use this approach, meaning fixating on the causes of this problem, asking why the child commits these problems, because most times they themselves are the mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Correct, Sayyid?
Correct.
Please continue the discussion and enlighten us further.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajhum. There are a few things that we need to also consider when we're trying to rectify, correct, and fix the mistakes of our kids. Like you said, we said the main point is how we look at things and make our aim and our goal the problem itself, not the child. We need to teach our children how they can learn from their mistakes. For example, if a child fails in a subject, you come to him and you tell him about the importance, for example, of time and how we should utilize and use time correctly, and how we could, or how we should have a balance between time and studying,
right,
and why is it important for a child, for example, to succeed and become a successful person and, you know, excel in his studies. When you teach him these things, that will create a sense of dignity within him. It makes him live, right? It makes him feel alive from within him. It gives him the right teaching, the positive teachings. rather than if you come and tell him off. Like, why are you stupid? Why are you this? Why are you that? You're failing. This person's better than you. This and that. So that kind of blaming system always, because it's negative,
it backfires.
It not just backfires, it will always give you a negative.
Right.
A negative will give you a negative. It's a math equation.
Of course.
A positive and positive will give you positive. So when you talk positive to your child and explain to him how he can learn from his mistakes, then he it becomes like a candle that would light the way for him, that would pave the way for him, that he can see with, and he can easily avoid mistakes in the future as he goes on. Why? Because he's been taught the right method. He's been taught why this is bad, and what he would get if he does this in this way, and so on and so forth. So he feels good about himself.
It also changes their perception, I think, because when they make a mistake, they just think, oh my God, I made a mistake, I messed up, this is going to be horrible. My parents are mad at me, and so on and so on.
Of course.
When the parent comes and tells them, you made a mistake, here's how to fix it.
Mm.
It completely changes their outlook for this problem and all other problems that they will face in life.
Of course. It creates a sense of trust in them when it comes to themselves and with the parents as well. That
right.
When they feel that the parent is willing to sit with them and negotiate rather than just slap them around,
right.
Which makes a huge difference. Another thing that as parents we need to teach them to learn to accept responsibility for their mistakes.
Right.
So instead of me just trying to bash them up or yell at them or scream at them for a mistake they made, no, let's teach them how they can accept responsibility and
fix the problem, right?
And then he will fix up the problem himself without having to, him having to blame his school or his teacher or his this and that. We can say to him, okay, if you don't want to study, that's a result. He knows now.
And on that note, we will take a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Dear listeners, welcome back to your program, Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to correctly fix the mistakes and wrongdoings of our children. They will say, please continue the discussion.
All right, so we're saying you need to teach him that he needs to accept responsibility for his mistakes. For example, like we said, if he's lacking at school because he doesn't do his work, you tell him that this failure of his school is due to the fact that he is not studying, not because the teacher is bad, the students are bad, the school is bad, because these are the reasons that we used to give our parents.
Yeah, of course.
Right? Like the teacher didn't teach us.
We know these reasons.
Yeah, he never said this. This is the worst school ever. So we always come up with excuses just so we could get away from this sense of responsibility. But if the parents teach the child, no, actually, that failure is because of your own. Because, for example, you did not use your time correctly, you did not do the right thing. So he needs to learn so he can fix his mistakes automatically without having to blame other people himself.
Doesn't this approach of making the children take responsibility for their action also kind of empowers them? Because whereas the problem before was the school and external factors that they have no control of, the problem is now something that they can fix. Doesn't this also maybe boost their confidence a little
bit? It does, of course it will. That's the whole idea when we're saying trying to fix the problem, not just to yell at them, see what the problem is, is actually to give them that sense of, that boost that you spoke about, or give them that confidence themselves. That they feel confident that they will avoid and fix the mistake. That's the whole idea, that's the whole aim we're trying to achieve here. Not just to get angry, slap them around, and try to act like a hero on their heads.
A very primitive reactions, if you ask
me. It is very primitive. So that's something that we need to do. Also, we as parents, when it comes to trying to fix the mistakes of our children, is that we need to make them feel the consequences of the danger. For example, when you make the child feel the consequences of the action that he does, he will be scared to do it again. For example, you say to him, like, this thing that you did, it will make people hate you.
Right.
And he's like, okay, you know what? I want people to like me. I don't want people to hate me. So he feels the consequences of the action itself. This thing, for example, will make you sick.
this thing will cause you this, this thing will cause you that. When he knows or she knows the consequences of their action, they will try to avoid it next time. Okay, I'm not going to do it. Because now he knows what would happen to him if this happens, you know? So he doesn't want, obviously, as even we as grown-ups, as, you know, believers in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah, that's how he talks about us in the Quran, that if you do this, this is the punishment that you're going to face. Right. So what do? We try to avoid them as much as we can. Because we don't want to face that kind of consequences. Allah is not the one who's saying, you know what, I'm going to punish you anyway. I'm the one who's going to pull you. So Allah says, whatever you do is because of what you've done yourself. It has nothing to do with me. I'm very merciful. I'm very loving.
Right.
All the mistakes, all the Jahannam that you will face, it is nothing but your own doing. You take yourself to hellfire by yourself. So once we know this, it gives us a sense of security that Allah loves us, Allah is merciful. I just need to fix myself.
Right.
And that's exactly what we need to do with children when they make a mistake as well.
But of course,
tell them the consequences, and whatever happens, they are responsible for it, which is the point that we mentioned before.
But of course, these consequences, they perhaps shouldn't be formulated in a very complex manner that adults can understand. Like, if you do this, it will have consequences for your children in the future, and I don't know what. It should be the formulations of this, these consequences should be understandable by the children, right? Because
exactly.
I've heard some strange things said to children by their parents, like, your children are going to suffer from this, and like in 10 years you will have back issues, and like,
yeah.
They cannot understand that.
Of course not.
Right.
Yeah. So it has to be something related to their capacity to understand, of course. So these are just simple, basic things, but like I said, sometimes, most of the times, they're overlooked.
Right. And on that note, we will take a quick break.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Welcome back to your listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are speaking about how to correctly fix the mistakes of our children without traumatizing them. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Another point that we have to take into consideration is that when a child makes a mistake, obviously he's not in the right mental state. So we need to be more sympathetic with them, and we need to show sympathy with them
when they make the mistake.
Even when they make a mistake. So, for example, say to them, look, I understand what you've done, I know how you feel. I wish that didn't happen, you couldn't, you know, that didn't happen, or that you didn't do that. I wish that didn't happen. And you know, I made the same thing before as well. But just having that kind of sympathy with the child, it gives him back his sense of confidence. Right, like, oh, you know what? Okay, so they care. They know what's going on. Okay, maybe I shouldn't do that again. And that might help the child to stop that action or fix it himself without, you know, you having to do a lot of effort. Because even when, as grown-ups, even as adults, when we make mistakes, if someone becomes more sympathetic with us, we get like an energy boost
exactly,
to do the right thing and trying to avoid
exactly.
it.